From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. I want to start with a sincere thank you to journalist Sarah Posner, who so graciously agreed to fill in for me last week. Thanks, Sarah. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners, and we are very thankful for that. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, October 25th is Hijra, the Islamic New Year. The 26th is Reformation Sunday for Protestant Christians. And of course, the 31st is All Hallows' Eve, the Christian prelude to All Saints' Day. And of course, it's also the secular high-caloric celebration of Halloween. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief show.
There's something basically un-American about forcing a bakery to bake a wedding cake for a couple they don't like.
You know, is it discrimination if they wanted to make a cake for them and their dog and, you know, they're going to get married to their dog? You know, is that something that's going to hold up? At what point do we say, okay, you know, this is not okay?
Enough is enough.
Mm-hmm. I'm a gay rights activist. I want to give $150,000 to someone who opposes gay marriage. Well, that's the provocative headline of a recent Washington Post column by Matt Stolansky. If the culture wars in this country sometimes seem like an ever-inflating balloon, Matt may have found the spiritual equivalent of a sharp pin. You'll hear his story in this hour at State of Belief Radio.
They want wider changes, recognition of civil unions, recognition of homosexual unions. The church cannot go in that direction. It would be a capitulation from the beauties and strengths of the Catholic tradition.
The recently ended Vatican Synod on the family managed to inspire, disappoint, and ultimately confuse almost everyone who was watching. 250 bishops from around the world gathered to demonstrate that, at bottom, the Roman Catholic hierarchy is both a pastoral and a political body. So what really happened, and how did secular media do in covering that? I'll ask Religion News Service Editor-in-Chief Kevin Ekstrom.
I felt like, you know what, I have no idea how to combat huge corporate lobbyists, but I cannot listen to that garbage.
In 2007, filmmaker Dan Carslake released his award-winning documentary, For the Bible Tells Me So. Dan's latest project is titled Every 3 Seconds. In a society where materialism reigns, what is the real secret to happiness?
We did 17,500 pounds today, and that's about 68,000 meals. Fantastic.
Well, I saw it on TV and thought, well, I've got to do something about it.
Dan Carslake will be back with us on this edition of State of Belief Radio. But first,
one person has been shot. We believe it to be a soldier at the war memorial.
Everyone in Parliament Hill, tourists, MPs, and staffers take cover. They're still in lockdown right now in that exchange of gunfire. We got to be very careful here, but is he connected to any ISIS account now in the wake of the radicalized event on Monday where another member of the Canadian Armed Forces was killed by someone on the RCMP watch list with connections to radicalized jihadist groups?
As investigators continue to look for connections with the ISIS terror group and other radicalizing influences, we're examining these tragedies with Dr. Mark Juergensmeyer, professor of sociology and director of global and international studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Mark, thanks for joining us again on State of Belief Radio.
My pleasure.
Some commentators have suggested that there's a connection between Canada's joining the fight against ISIS and these attacks against members of the military and against the parliament. Is it, in your opinion, too soon for that kind of speculation, or is that the right way to go?
Well, speculation by its nature is too soon. If we knew all the facts, we wouldn't be speculating.
You're right.
But there is some indication that the troubled young man who was involved in the parliament attacks was trying to get a passport to go to Syria. He's known to have connections with people who went to Syria as fighters with ISIS. So it's not implausible that this, in fact, turns out to be the case.
I'm also eager to ask you about the cases we've seen of American young people, as well as young people from other countries, attempting to join the terrorist forces in the Middle East.
It's a kind of an amazing thing, isn't it? The very same images of beheadings and kind of savage actions of the Islamic State activists in Syria and Iraq that repulse most of us and horrify us also have a kind of eerie appeal. Any kind of public violence is imagined power. It gives people a vaunted sense of their own importance, their power. If you hold life and death over another person, just think how unimaginably thrilling, in a sense, you can make these kinds of godlike decisions. It's horrible. It is sacrilegious in a very deep sense. It's a sacrilege to Islam as well as to Christianity. But you can understand psychologically the appeal, and that's the way to understand it, not to blame religion for the acts of people who are driven by their own psychological fantasy. All of us live kind of messy, boring lives, and part of the appeal of religion is to make us feel like we can be a part of something deeper and more important than ourselves, and that's a good thing. But you can see that it also is laced with another kind of fantasy, one that is much more self-serving, a sense that I can be much more important than I am. And for young people who, you know, may not be making it very well on their own, the guy who was involved in the Parliament attack was, by all accounts, a kind of loser. He wasn't making it in the world. He wasn't achieving. He wasn't going anywhere. But now he found something that could give him a sense of purpose. And you could see that for a lot of young people, even if they don't feel desperate about their situation or, in a sense, suicidal, but just feel morose about living a kind of, you know, dead-end life that's not really amounting to much, would be attracted to this extraordinary image of a fantastic cosmic war, great battle between good and evil and right and wrong, where your identity, and these are often people who feel marginalized because they are members of a minority community, who feel that my identity is suddenly very important. So you could understand the psychological appeal, and that's the answer. It's not religion. Don't go out on the streets looking for, oh, here's yet another case of how religion have motivated people into violence. People motivate themselves into violence, and they often use religion as a cloak.
What are the conversations that we should be having right now as individuals and as a society? Is there something more we should be doing or saying to discourage the kind of radicalization that we're seeing?
Well, one of the things we could do is what the Spanish government did after the Madrid train bomb attack some years ago that were carried out by Muslim minority community within Spain. They turned around and went overwhelmingly welcoming to this minority community. They saw this as an indication of people feeling marginalized and frustrated, and so they tried to reach out, and rather than alienate the Muslim minority community, said, oh, you're producing terrorists. They just did the opposite. They said, you're welcome, nurse. You're part of our community. You're part of our society. We want to show that we are a welcoming, interfaith, tolerant community that is open to people of all kinds of backgrounds. They took an approach that tried to counter the hatred that comes from marginalization by a sense of integration and tolerance and a welcoming spirit. That's one response.
Well, that's a very, very challenging proposal. Dr. Juergensmeyer, do you think things are going to get better or get worse in the months ahead?
You know, we live in kind of an interesting period of history where the idea of nationalism, a national community, secular nationalism, where everybody is welcome within the nation state, that's kind of changing in an era of globalization. There are large forces at work that affect the whole world. So it's no surprise that in every corner of the globe and in every religious tradition, religion is found as a kind of answer to contemporary social problems, not just personal problems, not just spiritual problems, problems of identity, accountability, and authority, a feeling of security. All of these things come to play. And in places like Syria and Iraq, which are kind of failed states after all, You can see how it'd be very easy for a predatory group, a kind of opportunistic infection of new radical extremist politics would take root. The sad thing for me is somebody who's a person of faith and who's always appreciated the value of religious traditions, not only in my life, but in the life of people I see around the world, is to see religion drug into it, mm-hmm. to see how often these power grabs, these attempts to try to mobilize people, because the nation state has failed, because nationalism is no longer the kind of draw that it used to be, what can you use as an appeal to kind of bring people together and give them a sense of identity? Well, that's where ethnicity and religion, these two ancient senses of community and identity, become very important, tragically, to my mind, because it deters at least some of us from seeing the value in mm-hmm. religious traditions, the healing power of religious traditions, and not just the destructive power.
What are the lessons that history offers us in dealing with terrorism masquerading as piety that you're turning to and saying, look back here and look now?
Movements like this have occurred in the past and even in the recent past, and they have a way of burning themselves out, because these are, after all, imagined states, this Islamic mm-hmm. state. There is imagined power, and the kind of illusion of power that's created with violence and with terrorism doesn't last very long. It's not real power. It's just a kind of show. It's a kind of tragic sense of pretend that won't last, and infighting will occur, and that's already occurring because they've mobilized so quickly, in part in Syria and Iraq, because they brought on board disaffected members of the Sunni community, moderate Sunnis in Iraq and Syria, who just felt alienated, marginalized by the governments in Damascus and Baghdad. So you can see why they've come on board, but you can also see why, you know, they're not going to stay on board
right.
very long with this kind of your rule by terrorism, which is what Baghdadi, the so-called caliph of the Islamic State, is doing. That's all he's got. That's the only thing in his arsenal, really, to try to hold people together, is to just intimidate and scare them. Well, that doesn't last forever,
yeah.
Thank God. And there will be internal divisions that will weaken it. And I think we have to be careful not to overreact, not to present ourselves as the kind of evil enemy that makes their picture of cosmic war, their argument that evil Europe and America is out to destroy Islam, to make their argument even easier. I think we need to support the moderate Muslim forces within the region who can go in the name of Islam and saying, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Islam is not a violent tradition. It's not a vicious tradition. You are abusing the tradition. And as most Muslim leaders have said, but they need to say that, of course, with force, and that means actually to attack from the outside and disrupt from inside that the dangerous combination between Islamic extremism and a vicious attempt at power that's being carried out in that region. It will fail. It will fail. But alas, there may be a good deal of destruction before that happens.
Dr. Mark Jurgensmeyer is professor of sociology and director of global and international studies at University of California, Santa Barbara. He's the author of the book, Terror in the Mind of God, The Global Rise of Religious Violence. Mark, I'm really pleased that you were with us again on State of Belief. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
Last week's guest host, Sarah Posner, conducted a fascinating interview with Catholic scholar Patty Miller regarding the Vatican Synod that was just wrapping up in Rome. At the time, there were hints of a new approach to ministry towards LGBT Catholics, as well as those who were divorced or practicing birth control. To follow up, I'm happy to be joined by Religion News Service Editor-in-Chief Kevin Ekstrom, who I am sure will tell us just how far the bishops went in following Pope Francis's lead toward an unprecedented openness and inclusivity. Welcome, Kevin. Did I get that right?
Well, it's a fairly short answer. They didn't go that far.
What actually transpired at that synod?
So basically, the Pope convened about 200 bishops and a few lay people to come together and, you know, talk about issues facing the family. halfway through, they issued kind of a midpoint report saying, here's where we are, here's what we're talking about. And that midpoint report was really striking in its language of welcoming lesbian and gay people, acknowledging that they have gifts to give to the wider church, that they basically have a home within the Catholic Church, and it's the church's responsibility to make that home comfortable for them. Mm-hmm. And this was sort of revolutionary language, because for centuries, popes, and even up until a couple of years ago, Pope Benedict XVI had been condemning gays and lesbians and using pretty harsh language about intrinsically disordered and grave moral evil and all of these sorts of things. And the church sounded like it was doing a complete 180. And nobody expected them to start marrying gay couples by any means, but the language that they were using and the tone was so striking. So that really freaked the conservatives out. They just went apoplectic and tried to put the brakes on this. And they partially succeeded. But as we reported this week, they may have won the battle, but they may not yet win the war. And so the final sort of statement from the church watered that language down. And instead of welcoming gays and lesbians, it was providing for them. Mm-hmm. And even that was a little wishy-washy as to what that meant. Here's the significant part, though. The bishops actually took votes on this statement, and a majority of the bishops signaled in their votes that they wanted a more welcoming place for gays and lesbians. That is unprecedented. It didn't get the two-thirds vote that it needed, but it was still a majority. So it technically failed, and the conservatives sort of won the day. But Pope Francis, being a fairly keen guy, ordered that that vote be made public and that it be included in the final report, even though it was technically, it failed, it didn't pass. He wants it in the final report so that people can look at it and debate it and keep chewing on it until the bishops reconvene a year from now for phase two of this family synod.
Kevin, is it correct to say that the current state of affairs could be termed a tyranny of the minority? And in answering that, also address the issue of some people being surprised that the Pope, the leader of the church, didn't get his way.
You know, the Catholic Church is not a democracy. Yes, there are majority and minority factions, but the conservatives in many ways represent what the church has been saying and has been teaching for hundreds of years. So it's not like there are a bunch of rogue dissidents, you know, that are trying to keep people down. I mean, at least from their perspective, they are upholding the teaching of the church as they have always understood it. And change like this comes slowly, and it's not easy, and it's not always pretty, which I think is kind of what we saw in Rome. Now, did the Pope lose? Well, yes, technically. I mean, he has been calling for a more open approach. He's been calling for less judgmentalism from the church. You know, he famously said, who am I to judge on the question of homosexuality? So you could cast this as a defeat for the Pope, but the Pope, like any savvy politician, has a long game plan here. And this is only the first in a series of steps that would need to happen and do need to happen for any kind of change, even a change in official tone to happen. So, you know, the Pope has his eye on the next synod a year from now. He knows that, you know, the church is, it's not an ocean liner. It's like seven ocean liners tied together. Like, you can't turn it on a dime. It's kind of like President Obama's approach to the whole LGBT issue. You know, people accuse him of moving too slow and not doing enough, but he had his eye on the final game plan, and you know what? President has pretty much gotten what he wanted on gay rights, at least on the marriage question, and don't ask, don't tell in the military. So he's playing the long game, and I think Pope Francis is doing the same thing.
Was mainstream media effective in confusing their audience about what happened in Rome and what it means, or was it better than that?
True confession. You know, when that midpoint report came out, our correspondent in the Vatican emailed me and said, you know, the church is talking about gay and divorced Catholics. And I wrote back, I said, well, that's what they've been talking about for a long time. Like, what's new here? And it took me a while to sort of absorb, like, exactly what had happened. Now, a lot of the media really ran with this, front page of major newspapers. And so I think there was a great degree of media hype here. But I don't think that the media overplayed this, because if you think about it, they were going with what the line from the Vatican was. And the Vatican statement came out and said X, Y, and Z. And you've got to remember that nothing comes out from the Vatican that's going to be a surprise to the Pope. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether or not he, you know, personally approved of this midpoint report that got all the attention, but certainly he didn't disagree with it, or else it never would have come out. Mm-hmm. So I think the Pope was actually using the media in some ways very mm-hmm. effectively to get people talking about this and to get people excited mm-hmm. about, you know, a bunch of bishops sitting in a room talking about things, which doesn't usually happen. So I think the Pope very skillfully and savvily used the media, and the media played along.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that they were irresponsible, but I think it was very easy to get carried away
yeah.
with the Catholic Church is changing its teaching, which they weren't doing and they weren't going to do.
Yeah.
And I think some media did swallow it a little too quickly, but I think it was very deliberate.
Kevin, let's talk just for a second about your shop, the Journalist at Religion News Service, covering this kind of historic process accurately. What's the biggest challenge to doing that?
I think the biggest challenge is what we were saying, is to not get carried away and to not see this as a done deal, or to not play into the expectations game. You know, President Obama actually has a lot in common with Pope Francis, and, you know, they both were met with these sort of sky-high expectations that they were going to come in and this breath of fresh air and everything was going to change. And then when it didn't change, people get frustrated and then they get disappointed. We try to be very careful not to raise expectations too high, or at least unnatural or unrealistic expectations. There's a lot that is going to change at the Catholic Church, but it's not going to happen overnight. It's very easy also to get in a left-right paradigm. You know, mm-hmm. we've got the conservatives on one side and the liberals on the other. But when we're talking about the Catholic Church,
mm-hmm.
a liberal bishop is really a relative term, because they're all conservatives to start with, really. So you have to be careful not to paint people into either-or categories, because it's much more complicated and much more nuanced than that. And so what we try to do is provide the context to show that this is not the Iowa caucuses. You know, there are winners and losers, but it's not as black and white as it might first seem.
So, Kevin, you and I get on an elevator together, and I tell you I'm only going to the sixth floor, but I want you to tell me what I need to know about what happened at that extraordinary synod.
Yeah, the whole elevator speech. Yeah, you're good. The elevator speech is Pope Francis is trying to steer the church towards a more open and embracing position towards people that it has previously condemned. And he's getting a lot of pushback from it, but he may well end up being able to do it, because I think a lot of people see the writing on the wall.
Kevin Ekstrom is editor-in-chief at Religion News Service, the premier secular journalistic organization providing unbiased reporting on matters of religion for over 75 years. That doesn't mean Kevin's been there 75 years. At religionnews.com. Kevin, as always, thank you for being with us once again on State of Belief Radio and making us smarter for you having been here.
You're very welcome.
There can be no winners in a culture war. Sure, there are moments that feel like big wins, and stoking the fires of conflict can lead to impressive fundraising. But depersonalizing those we disagree with and coming to see them as a faceless enemy is profoundly destructive and profoundly dangerous, regardless of how sincere the convictions that drive the polarization may be. Now, one alternative to the hopeless us-against-them stalemate exists. Meet Matt Stalansky. His recent Washington Post column is titled, "I'm a Gay Rights Activist. I want to give $150,000 to someone who opposes gay marriage." Matt, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, who is it that you want to give $150,000 to?
So the family that we are trying to interface with is the Klein family out of Oregon, who basically has been all over national media the result of an event that took place a while ago. in which a lesbian couple who had previously worked with a baker for different clients went in and approached the baker and asked them to bake a cake for their wedding. The Kleins refused to bake the cake, citing their religious conviction, stating that they didn't want to send any signal of approval of gay weddings or gay marriage.
What in the world made you consider this approach?
I think we study this thing called apologetics. So the idea of how we communicate our faith, and then the idea is sort of a presuppositional apologetics, how we do that in such a way that it actually gets through to the people that we're trying to get through to. And I think what struck me was that both sides were really just talking past each other here, that Christians are shouting condemnation and saying the same trite phrases, love the sinner, hate the sin, over and over again, without any real consideration of what's actually happening in the community, what people actually think, how that message is actually settling with them.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea kind of came about after the Supreme Court ruled that they were not going to hear any of the cases from the lower courts that had thrown out these individual states' notions of overturning gay marriage bans within those states.
Uh-huh. Are you hopeful that this kind of non-confrontational search for a solution can help challenge the us-against-them mentality that seems to define the culture wars?
I think so. I think it's incumbent upon me and other gay Christians to sort of help define this middle ground, right, which is what I've seen as a result of the fundraiser that I started and of this initiative and of an initiative that I'm working with called Evangelicals for Marriage Equality is that there are very few people actually in this space. There are very few gay people who are trained in bibliology that have sort of the hermeneutical tools that speak Hebrew and Greek that can go into churches and work with pastors and church communities and make things better. And, you know, there are very few gay people that have spoken out that I've heard from who are actively involved in their faith in the gay community. So there's just such a tiny overlap, and frankly, at some point, it falls on us as gay Christians to really kind of bridge this divide, because you're right, it's absolutely us versus them, and the question of how we build a bridge between the two communities is an important one. It's important, Welton, because gay evangelical kids kill themselves at rates 8 times higher than any other at-risk gay youth. And what does the church have to say about that? You know, the church can keep repeating the same trite phrases over and over again about love the sinner, hate the sin. But the gay kids in its body, in this body of Christ, are killing themselves.
Yeah.
Because parents have nothing to say other than hate to their children. And so we're really trying to figure out a way to reach out to Christians from the perspective of homosexuals and say, the messaging isn't working. It's just causing tragedy. How do we start to bridge this divide? It's also fundamentally devaluing gay people as real people, as real whole people, because Christians can once again sit back and say all they want that marriage is a religious institution. But the fact of the matter is that it's also a civil institution. Mm-hmm. Whether Christians like it or not, there is such thing as civil marriage. And if you're going to offer it to heterosexual people, you must also offer it to gay people. And so I think this confusion that I've seen in the Christian community of what is a marriage and why does that matter from a faith perspective versus a legal or civil perspective is what's driving a lot of this hatred. So if people could just get right in their minds, look, we currently allow Muslims and Jews and people of every creed and kind and color to participate in the civil institution of marriage, though they would not meet the standard of what we believe as Christians, the standard of a Christian marriage would be. But we allow them to be civilly married. We don't protest. We don't get angry when people who don't follow Jesus get married. We're only doing it for this group of people that are homosexual.
Yeah.
And the question is, why can't you just apply the same standard to civil marriage to gay people as you apply to everyone else that doesn't qualify for what you view as the Christian standard for marriage?
Well, that is an approach that I've been commending for a long time, because honestly, the question about support for same-sex marriage in the United States is not a question at all about whether you're a good Christian or Muslim or Jew. It's a question of whether or not you're a good American and wants to see the Constitution apply to everybody.
That's right. And the question is actually also one of faith. What does Christ teach us to do when people disagree with us?
Yeah.
Legislate against them? Tell them we hate them? No, we're talking about a Savior who got on the floor and washed the feet of Judas moments before Judas betrayed him. And Christ knew that was coming. So in what world could we imagine that same Jesus going into the Klein bakery today and telling them not to bake a cake for those lesbians? It's an outrage to the teaching of Jesus Christ.
So, Matt, what kind of responses have you received so far since you went public with this idea?
You know, it's been a very wide range. I think both communities actually have had sort of a split response. You see a lot of people who are tired of the anger and frustration and hate and who want to do something and contribute and send a positive message and really start to build these bridges. But you see a lot of people, the gay community feels fairly strongly that I'm helping homophobes, that I'm defending homophobia, and I'm an apologist for homophobia, and that I shouldn't be spending any money helping people that discriminated. I should be taking that money instead and spending it on other things. And from the Christian view, you have this idea that we're heathens and we have, quote-unquote, sold out to faggotry and our money is dirty and that I am the father of Satan, someone called me, for trying to use the words and teaching of Christ against other Christians. And this is all just deception and confusion. So you really see the claws start to come out. I think that means that I'm onto something here. I think that means we're doing the thing that Christ taught us, that Martin Luther King so preached about in his time, which is in the very moment that you can destroy your enemy, you don't do it, because we're not in the business of destroying people. We don't want to see people suffer. We just want to see the erosion of evil systems, and we just want to see the erosion of hatred and a better, happier, healthier world in which all Americans can live as they wish to live.
Yeah. Earlier in this interview, you mentioned Evangelicals for Marriage Equality. Matt, I know you're on the board of advisors for this new nonprofit, working with our friend Brandon Robertson of the Revangelical Movement. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing with Evangelicals for Marriage Equality.
Well, our big initiative right now, and I hope everyone would be willing who's listening to help us out with this, is we're trying to have this topic of civil marriage equality for gay people brought up in the Southern Baptist Convention. And we're just a few hundred signatures short. So what we're asking people to do is go to our website at evangelicalsforequality.com and sign our petition, which basically just says that you're raising your voice with us, that you'd like for the topic to be brought to discussion, simply that. These are the types of interventions that we're trying to create, which is really just the space for dialogue, not forcing anything down anyone's throat, but really just going into evangelical spaces and bringing up this theme of civil marriage equality.
The conference of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention is coming up right away, next week, as a matter of fact. The gathering of signatures is taking place right now. A deadline is October 27th. That is this coming Monday. So, Matt, tell our listeners why it is so important for them to sign on to this statement by Monday, please.
It's important because it's time for the Christian faith, for the Church of Jesus Christ, to recognize the full identity of all Christians. And it's time that we take the teachings of Jesus Christ and live them out, which is to love our neighbor as ourselves without asking the question of do they deserve it or not. The question is not one of merit. We don't love people because they deserve it. We love people because Christ loved us first without merit. And so in that vein, we're asking all Christians, and especially at this moment, Southern Baptists, to come to the table with us and have a conversation about what that looks like and about how we treat people equally as fellow citizens of a country. Could I quickly add, if you'd like to support the initiative in supporting, sending a message of love in the face of discrimination to the Klein family, we'd ask that you go to rally.org/this-is-love. Mm-hmm. Again, that's rally.org/this-is-love. And there you can either send a message of support or love to the Klein family, tell them that you're praying for them and their children, or you can actually make a donation if that's something that you'd be interested in and prayerfully considering.
Thank you. I'm glad you added that. Matt Stilansky is a member of the advisory board for the new nonprofit Evangelicals for Marriage Equality. We'll link to the website from stateofbelief.com. Matt's recent Washington Post column is titled, "I'm a Gay Rights Activist. I Want to Give $150,000 to Someone Who Opposes Gay Marriage." Matt, thanks to you for being with us on State of Belief today and being so aggressive in getting out this message.
Thank you so much, and peace and grace, and many thanks to you and all of your listeners for hearing me out.
We introduced you to award-winning filmmaker Dan Carslake back in 2007, I believe it was, when his powerful documentary For the Bible Tells Me So helped launch the important conversation about religion and LGBT persons. Dan's new project is a film entitled Every 3 Seconds, a really magnificent piece. Dan joins us from Berlin. Dan, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Hey, Welton, it's great to be here.
You tell one story in every 3 seconds, even as you profile 5 very different individuals. What is that overarching story?
The story really comes from the fact that every 3 seconds, somebody dies somewhere in the world from hunger or extreme poverty. Usually it's a child, and usually it's from a preventable disease. And we just wanted to make a film, not so much about hunger and poverty, but about how simple and easy it is all of us to engage in the end of hunger and poverty. You know, the people that work in hunger and poverty alleviation these days all agree we have all the tools we need to solve it. We could be the ones on the globe right now to end hunger and poverty for the first time in human history, but the only thing lagging behind, the only thing we don't have, is our will to do it. So in every 3 seconds, we profile these 5 people who, instead of feeling hopeless or having a good intention to do something, actually just quit and end up doing one thing and then doing another. And each of them not only change the world, but they change themselves at the same time.
Dan, if you would pick one of the 5 stories and just give us a sense of why you included it in every 3 seconds.
It is tough to pick one. Let's see. I guess I would go with Ingrid Monroe, who is this incredible Swedish woman who, the year she retired from a job she was doing for the UN in Nairobi, had the occasion to meet 50 women who were living on the streets of Nairobi begging with their children. So these were 50 mothers who, with their kids, were living on the streets and depending on the money they were making begging. Well, Ingrid was very interested in how microfinance might work for the poorest of the poor, these beggars in Nairobi. So she took $600 of her own money the year she retired, divided it 50 ways, gave each woman a microloan of $12 each. She grouped them into small groups of 5 so they could support each other, and then helped them each start their own small microbusiness. Some of them bought a cell phone, which they rented out in their village for a dime a call, and some bought vegetables from a local farmer and took them to a market and sold them for a profit. And so she trained these women to start their own businesses, pay back that initial loan, and then if they needed to, take a second loan for double that amount, $24, and buy 2 more phones or buy more vegetables, and on and on and on. And she watched as this microfinance bank that she started with this initial $600 has now become, 15 years later, the largest microfinance bank in East Africa. It's called Jami Bora, and it has more than 350,000 members, and she's probably helped about 1.5 million people climb themselves out of poverty. It's an amazing microfinance story. It's an amazing senior story because, as I've said, she didn't start this until she was retired.
You know, Dan, one of the things that strikes me about all 5 of these activists is how happy they are. You are also saying in this documentary, here are 5 people who have found an antidote for the pervasive materialism that makes so many people unhappy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was equally as striking to me as I got to know these people how incredibly happy they were. And one of the interesting parts of my research, and it's in the film a bit, there is all this science now that's been looking at the effect of altruism and compassion and empathy on our body's physiological being. When people are doing something good or something that they perceive that is outside of their own interest, it has a palpable and real physiological effect on the body. It is helping their immune system. It is slowing their breathing and slowing their heart rate. and really helping them ward off disease by boosting the immune system. So not only is it a psychological high that people get that we all have experienced when we've done something good for somebody else, there are actual physical benefits to doing good in the world.
It also strikes me that each one of these people seems genuinely surprised at the extraordinary impact their seemingly ordinary actions have had.
Yeah, I mean, it's really important for people when they're thinking about how they can engage in the world, whether it's in the end of poverty and hunger or in some other incredibly important issue, child trafficking or military spending or however you want to engage in the world to make it a better, safer place that works for everyone. People tend to feel overwhelmed and tend to feel like they have to change the world with their first step. And really, one of the big messages of the film is none of these people went into it thinking they would have, you know, this global impact, that changing the world meant only changing everything globally. Each one of these characters just took one step. They saw something in front of them, some way to engage that was simple and basic, and they stepped into it and did it, and then watched what happened, and then took the next step, and the next step. So you don't have to really plan your whole trajectory when you start. The message is just start, just engage.
Talk about how our listeners can get their hands on this film and tell us the resources for organizing a viewing of it.
Well, the film is now available globally. It is available to rent or to buy on iTunes. You can buy the DVD itself and have it in your hands. If you want an actual DVD, you can buy it from our website or at Amazon.com and everywhere that sells movies in that way. People who want to have either screenings in community centers or churches or schools can also go to our website, which is every3seconds.net, and just click on I Want to Have a Screening, and that will take you directly to our distributor, First Run Features in New York, who will help you set up that kind of screening. A couple other ways to see it, November 18th, I believe, it becomes available on Netflix. And if you are outside of the U.S. or Canada, you can see the film on Vimeo International. So we've got it covered globally, which is exciting. And it's very easily seen immediately, which I love. The Internet is good for a lot of things, but for a filmmaker, it's particularly exciting because so many more people have access to your work.
Dan, why'd you do it? What made you want to do this film?
When I was cutting for The Bible Tells Me So, in the summer of 2006, I went to visit my parents. I was there over a Sunday, so we went to the Sunday church service, and I heard a sermon about the fact that every 3 seconds somebody dies, and I thought, I can't believe that. I thought it was wrong, actually. I was convinced that somehow the preacher had gotten his facts wrong. I couldn't believe that 30,000 people were dying every day from something that is now solvable. So as I finished for the Bible and it was headed towards Sundance, I started reading more and more about hunger and poverty alleviation, and I realized that not only do 30,000 people die a day, it was also true that virtually everyone agreed that it was solvable. So as For the Bible Tells Me So opened, I thought, what is something I'd really be passionate about? What's the next message I want to be part of getting out in the world? And the message I decided would be that this huge thing that we've always had with us is now solvable, and we are the ones we've been waiting for. Let's just do this.
Yeah.
So I felt very moved and passionate about getting that message out.
What did it do to Dan Carslake to make every 3 seconds?
It made me realize that I am as hungry as the people that we consider hungry, people without enough food and enough water and basic medical care, because I'm socialized to want bigger, more, better, newer. And getting involved in the end of hunger personally for me has ended my need for, you know, material things. I have very little want anymore because I now have more of a relationship with enough in my life.
Dan Carslake is an award-winning filmmaker who powerfully explored religion and homosexuality in the documentary For the Bible Tells Me So. His new film, which I'm confident you'll find inspiring and eye-opening, is called Every 3 Seconds. The film's website is every3seconds.net. Dan, congratulations on another terrifically important project, and Thank you for what you do. Thank you for being willing to take time and share stories with us on State of Belief Radio. Thank you for being just a really good person in this world.
Thank you so much, Walton. I can say all of those things right back to you. Thanks so much.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. My goodness, time passes when you're having fun. The ongoing financial support of State of Belief listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. A big thank you to listeners who've made a donation this week. If you find value in what we're doing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Broadcast messages of fear, hate, and division are easy to find on any radio dial. Endless tirades about how faith in America is under attack are impossible to avoid. And if the goal is to escalate the culture wars, what better way than to pit one group of Americans, for example, sincere conservative Christians who run private businesses, against another, well-meaning LGBT persons, many of whom are people of faith, who simply want recognition of their committed, loving relationships. It is great for fundraising, and it is terrible, terrible for our society. What we're doing is far more uncommon. We bring you the stories of thoughtful, committed leaders and activists struggling for real solutions, not permanent polarization. Matt Stilansky is a tremendous example of just that kind of struggle. You heard from Matt on this week's show. Now, who do you know who would benefit from hearing his thoughts? We make the show very easy to share. Sign up for our podcast at stateofbelief.com. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/stateofbelief. And share the stories you find compelling with your friends. The same goes for Twitter. We're at twitter.com/stateofbelief. It's a great way for you to be an active part of getting these important voices to reach more people at a time when the noise in social media threatens to drown them out completely. And having State of Belief on radio stations nationwide is an essential part of reaching an audience that might never know to go looking for us. This week, we're delighted to welcome KYAQ 91.7 FM. Local public radio for the Oregon Central Coast to the State of Belief family. Welcome, friends. Welcome to the conversation. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.